Pick through the chaos on our producer's shelves, and you'll find a small white book called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. The book's cover shows an odd diagram full of shapes with words inside connected by arrows. If you puzzle it out, it says, "This is a novel by Jan Levin and a story of coded secrets and psychotic delusions of mathematics and war told by a physicist obsessed with the lives of Alan Turing and Kurt Gödel, a story completely imagined but entirely true." Jan Levin is the physicist, and we took her at her word that this is a novel, but there was plenty that Steve Paulson wanted to know. He asked Jan Levin to read the opening of her book.
"There is no beginning. I've tried to invent one, but it was a lie, and I don't want to be a liar. The story will end where it began, in the middle. A triangle or a circle, a closed loop with three points. At one apex is a paranoid lunatic. At another is a lonesome outcast. Kurt Gödel, the greatest logician of many centuries, and Alan Turing, the brilliant codebreaker and mathematician. These two people converge in history and diverge in belief. They act out lives that are only tangentially related, and deaths that are written for each other, inverted reflections. They are both brilliantly original and outsiders. They are both loyal to reason and to truth. They are both besotted with mathematics. But for all of their devotion, mathematics is indifferent. Unaltered by any of their dramas, Gödel's psychotic delusions, Turing's sexuality. 1 + 1 will always be 2. Their broken lives are mere anecdotes in the margins of their discoveries. But then their discoveries are evidence of our purpose, and their lives are parables on free will. Against indifference, I want to tell their stories. Don't our stories matter?"
Your book is called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. What is a Turing machine?
Turing machine started out as a thought experiment. It was when Alan Turing tried to imagine mechanizing human thought, and it was really the precursor to the idea of the computer.
Now, Alan Turing ended up with a very tragic life, well, a tragic end, but he was quite brilliant before that, and there seemed to be a lot of drama in his life. For instance, as he was growing up at boarding school, he seemed to have had some rather miserable experiences, at least as you portray them in your book.
Yeah, he was a bit of an outcast. I think Turing was one of these childlike personalities and childish. He was also probably autistic, so he had trouble reading the emotional current in the room. He really had trouble interpreting an expression on someone's face. He had trouble modulating his voice. He was a very awkward person.
Why was he so drawn to mathematics?
He was a person who loved honesty and truth. It's even wrong to say loved it. It was the only way for him. There was no alternative to brutal honesty and frankness. And the pursuit of truth for him was just an intrinsic desire that he always seemed to have.
Now, later on, Alan Turing turned out to be a critical part of the war effort during the Second World War when he worked for the British for their intelligence office at Bletchley Park. Can you explain what he did there?
Well, he was a cryptanalyst, so he was trying to crack the German Enigma codes. There were literally millions of different possible combinations for cracking this code. It was almost impossible to imagine that it could be done, but he succeeded in doing it. And it really had a huge impact in turning the tide of the war in favor of the British.
Now, you would think that this would have made him a national hero, and yet not. Too much after that, he had a terrible end. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, you'd think he would be a national hero, but Churchill, although he admired them deeply, had a real soft spot for the cryptanalysts. He wanted to keep secret what they had done. So he was never publicly heralded as this great war hero, although privately Churchill and people in the government knew that he was and accepted him as that. But later when he went to Manchester after the war and he was working on building a real computer, he was involved with a young sort of rogue he picked up on the street. He was homosexual, and he made no attempt to suppress his homosexuality or to hide it. And he had been burgled by an associate of this person he was having an affair with, Arnold Murray. And he went to the police to tell them about the robbery, and people told him not to go to the police. It wasn't much that was stolen. It was a few odds and ends, nothing serious. But this is a person who could not let go of something that was wrong. He could not live with something that was not right, not honest, not forthright. And so he went to the police and in the process disclosed that he had a homosexual affair and was very soon after arrested for gross indecency, as it was called.
And what happened after that?
Well, there was a trial. He was convicted, and the sentence at the time was either prison or hormonal castration, and he was given chemical castration. He was given doses of estrogen over a 2-year period and eventually an estrogen implant, which he was allowed to have removed when the sentence was over. But this left him obese. He grew breasts. He became profoundly depressed, and he never really rebounded. About 2 years after that, he committed suicide.
By eating a poisoned apple.
Yes, he bit from a poison apple. Snow White was his favorite movie, and he used to run around chanting, "Dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through." So he was a real character. He was fascinated by this movie, and then for him to take that, to actually use this as his suicide, he dipped an apple in cyanide, bit from the apple, and died very swiftly.
You would think that someone, knowing his history, knowing that all he had accomplished, knowing his patriotism, would have rescued him.
It was just sort of a tragedy. Here is this outcast, but this charming, likable, sweet, but really not functional person who, again, falls prey to exactly that combination. He's frank, charming, sweet, and open, and yet just does not seem to understand the social current or what it meant that he was disclosing his homosexuality or what could happen to him.
Now, there's another major historical figure in your novel. Is Kurt Gödel the dreaming madman of your title?
You know, that's a good question. I played with the title has could be planted on various things. I mean, you could say Gödel was clearly more insane than Turing. Turing was not insane. He was odd or eccentric, rather. But Gödel was a paranoid schizophrenic. He really did have breaks with reality. And so you could imagine he is the madman dreaming of Turing machines. But I think in the book I was playing a lot with the idea of truth and what's true and the narrator being a liar, so that at some point it's hard to know if the narrator has invented everything and if any of it's real. And then you have to wonder at some stage if the reader is inventing everything, if any of it's real, you know, so the reader has to feel a little mad in the process of reading the book, not knowing what they can really claim is real and true.
Now, this is another remarkable story. I mean, you just mentioned that that Kurt Gödel was a schizophrenic. I mean, he sort of slipped in and out of reality. He's also considered one of the greatest logicians who's ever lived.
Absolutely, probably the greatest logician since Aristotle. He was a tremendous mind. I mean, he did things that eluded everyone else, that no one could find. He could find it hidden there, this remarkable nugget of mathematical truth that was just so difficult to get at. He was clearly a genius, but he had trouble believing in ordinary reality. He really believed that numbers were real and that circles were real, and there was this platonic reality that he could get to just by the power of his mind. And he trusted it more than he trusted this ordinary reality, which had to do with people and germs and things that he really couldn't measure or be sure were real. He was very confused about reality.
Now, Kurt Gödel also had a tragic end. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it's, again, in direct reflection of Turing's suicide. It's almost a perfect opposite, perfectly carved opposite. He was so afraid that his food was being poisoned, that the government was poisoning him, that he stopped eating altogether. Now, he had had a lifelong history of self-starvation, and he had often dropped to dangerously low weights, but his wife, Adele, who was much older than him and very motherly, would nurse him back to health spoonful by spoonful until he gained some weight. But she fell ill and was unable to care for him. And without her, I think he just fell apart. He lost his grip entirely. And he starved himself to death. He was 65 pounds when he died. And even in the hospital, they couldn't get him to eat.
Now, are you drawing a link between madness and genius here?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I'm not really. And I don't think Turing was mad. He was not.
But Gödel was.
There are lots. But Gödel was. But he wasn't mad while he was doing his great work. And that doesn't mean there isn't a link, obviously. People say maybe if you're vulnerable to madness, it's also something in your brain chemistry that makes you open to great insight or great genius. But we've had a lot of geniuses who are not insane. Einstein is the greatest genius of, you know, physics for 300 years. And or Richard Feynman, who's another physics genius, was clearly not insane, a very socially smooth, suave, sort of charismatic person. But I think that there's something fascinating in the story, just in terms of its sort of human character, that there's these people who are absolutely heroic beyond almost human ability, and yet their weaknesses are also so much more terrifying than ordinary weakness. And there's something about that tragic combination that I think is very fascinating, and it's kind of an exaggeration of what everyone sort of feels, that there's something about them that's great, but there's also the same thing that's usually terrible or ridiculous. And so I think it kind of appeals to us to see these bigger, epic versions of the human predicament.
But it does make you wonder if somehow their weaknesses, whether it's just gross social incompetence or, in Gödel's mm-hmm. case, you know, these episodes mm-hmm. of madness, whether mm-hmm. whether that in fact, well, it didn't necessarily make them geniuses, but it contributed to their obsessive quality to pursue mathematics as they did.
Well, I do think that is true. I do think that it takes a certain willingness to be outside of an ordinary life and be outside of an ordinary world. And I really did want to convey that to people reading it, to step inside this other world, these people who get their meaning in life from the purity of mathematics, from that pursuit. I'm not going to call it religious, but I think it does lend, a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of context, and it gives their lives a richness that they cannot find in the ordinary world, in the ordinary kind of life. And it's those things like being obsessively logical, devoted to truth, brash and blunt, and again, obsessive, that makes them on the outside of the rest of the world.
Jenna Levin is a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University. She spoke with Steve Paulson. A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines is her first novel.